From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Twenty-six reporters are missing in southern Iraq, among them NPR's Neil Conan, The New York Times' Chris Hedges, and CNN's Greg LaMotte. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Bill Buesenberg, NPR's vice president for news, about what's being done to try to locate the journalists. Also, we talk about the uprising in southern Iraq with Middle East scholar R.K. Ramazani. Actor Anthony Hopkins tells us how he prepared for the role of Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter in the new movie The Silence of the Lambs. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us if high school makes for good TV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Clashes continue in southern Iraq between anti-government forces and Saddam Hussein loyalists. Reports from the area say the situation is confused and chaotic and is changing hour by hour. Jim Muir filed this report for the BBC.
It's clear that virtually every major town and center in the mainly Shiite south of the country has been caught up in the anti-government unrest. Iraqi opposition sources say the uprising, as they're calling it, has taken complete control of a number of important towns, including Al-Amara and the Shiite holy towns of Najaf and Karbala. They say 2,000 more Iraqi army troops have gone over to the rebellion, and that a prison near Baghdad has been stormed and thrown open. But some refugees making from the Kuwaiti border indicated that Saddam's loyalist forces, with the Republican Guard to the fore, are starting to put the rebels under severe pressure. A spokesman for the radical Shiite opposition conceded that government forces had recaptured part of Basra, while refugees said that Zubair, a town on the outskirts of Basra, had been surrounded and cut off by the Republican Guard.
Jim Muir for the BBC in Nicosia. An American colonel said today that 7 Kuwaiti soldiers have been killed in drive-by attacks as they guarded checkpoints in the streets of Kuwait City. Colonel Jesse Johnson, in charge of special operations for the U.S. forces, said that it's not clear who's been doing the shooting. Johnson said that so far, 300 Iraqi soldiers have been found in Kuwait City and taken to POW camps. It was a day of celebration in support of troops in the Persian Gulf today in Cincinnati. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU has a report.
About 7,500 people gathered in downtown Cincinnati for a noon rally to honor the troops and commemorate the victory in the Persian Gulf. Cincinnati Mayor David Mann says the day was an occasion to tell soldiers the country appreciates their sacrifice.
It's a day of joy and thanksgiving. Thanksgiving that the war is over, that the war was so successful, that the casualties were so low. This is also a day for us to express gratitude to the leadership of President Bush, the leadership of General Powell, the leadership of General Schwarzkopf.
There was also a moment of silence to remember those who died in the war. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
President Bush said today that the war on crime should receive the same commitment as the war in the Gulf. The president spoke before an administration crime summit composed of more than 650 police chiefs and law enforcement officials. He used the occasion to push for his anti-crime bill, which stalled last year in a House committee. The president said U.S. troops may have been safer in the Allied ground offensive than they would have been on the streets at home. The Dow Industrials gained 58 points today to close at 2,972.5. This is NPR News. Kuwaiti officials said today that at least 10,000 foreigners are expected to be deported from the country for collaborating with the Iraqi occupation. Sheikh Ahmed al-Sabah, head of the main Kuwaiti resistance group, said that those expelled would include Palestinians, but that Kuwait should not single out any nationality. He said that many of the 350,000 Palestinians in Kuwait helped resist the Iraqi army. A sixth tampered-with Sudafed package has been found in the Tacoma area today in Washington state, 2 days after a nationwide recall of the cold medicine. In the past month, at least 2 people have died and another became seriously ill after taking cyanide-laced capsules. Martin Munguia, member station KUOW, has more.
After hearing about the recall on the news, a Tacoma couple took a second look at a recently purchased package of Sudafed 12-hour cold capsules. One of the capsules was irregular. It was yet another tampered package to be found in the Tacoma Olympia area in the past week. FBI officials have not determined if any of those capsules contain cyanide, but it's strongly suspected. Local county coroners are now reviewing any suspicious or unsolved deaths within the past month to see if anyone else may have been a victim of the poisoning. In Tumwater, police say they are looking at one person of interest. FBI spokesperson John Iyer says during the course of this investigation, there are likely to be several others, but so far he says there are no actual suspects. For National Public Radio, I'm Martin Lungia in Seattle.
Israel's UN ambassador has set out to prove that the Palestine Liberation Organization supported and encouraged Iraq in what he called unprovoked acts of aggression. Ambassador Yoram Arador circulated 7 pages of statements by PLO leaders as a UN document. Arador said the statements are proof that the PLO exhorted Saddam Hussein to wage war and to use his weapons of mass destruction against the civilian population of Israel. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. About 26 journalists have been reported missing in Iraq, and it is believed they are being held prisoner. One of them, Neil Conan, is our colleague at NPR. He was traveling on the way to Basra with New York Times reporter Chris Hedges. Also reported missing are 2 journalists from CNN, Greg LaMotte and Tyrone Edwards. Most of the missing journalists are French. Bill Buesenberg is NPR's vice president for news and information programs. He told me what he knows about what happened to the journalists and who might be holding them.
There's a lot of conflicting information, so I can't say that we know absolutely everything for sure. But the best information we have, which comes from other journalists in the area, was that this is Neil Conan and a reporter, Chris Hedges of the New York Times, drove in a white Land Rover with other cars up toward Basra Monday morning, leaving about 8 o'clock from Kuwait City there. We believe they were stopped at a checkpoint and that they were taken into custody in some way by the Republican guards in that area outside of Basra. We think they may be held together with all the other journalists who are also missing, some 26 or 27, most of which are French, about 15 are French. We think they're all being held together in a barracks in Basra. That comes from a couple of different people, but I think it's not hard and certainly not confirmed, and we can't make sure that's absolutely certain, but that's the best information we have now.
What kind of work is being done behind the scenes now to try to figure out for sure who's holding them and what could be done to get their release?
Well, we're doing everything we can, and I mean everything. We're talking, obviously, to all parts of the U.S. government, the National Security Council and the State Department and the Pentagon and the Central Command in Riyadh and Capitol Hill. A number of congressional leaders have made calls on our behalf, so we have a lot we're doing in Washington and in Saudi Arabia. We're also calling foreign embassies and talking with Iraqi government officials at the United Nations and at embassies in Europe. We're also working, I think one of the main things is working with other journalist organizations who are involved, CNN and the New York Times, for example. CNN has already taken, through their reporter in Baghdad, Peter Arnett, has taken all of these names of these journalists to the Iraqi government in Baghdad and asked that they be released there, so they are well aware of it at that level. We're working. The other organizations we've called and have been asked for their help include the International Red Cross, Amnesty International, the United Nations. We are doing literally everything we can and talking to everyone we can think of to help in this case and see if we can get them released.
The CBS just went through this with 4 of their journalists. And after, I think it was 42 days, the journalists were released. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes work, and I know the Soviets were supposed to have been very influential in that. Is there anything that could be extrapolated from the CBS experience that you think could help you now?
Well, that's what we're doing. We, in fact, talked to CBS, and their advice was be optimistic, and it may be a long term. They did send someone to Baghdad, and they worked in Baghdad the whole time. We're quite willing to do that if we can get a visa to get in to help there. We did talk to the Soviets. Our reporter in Moscow, Ann Cooper, has been in contact with both the foreign ministry and the president's office as well, which CBS recommended. The recommendation from CBS was basically to make this as visible as possible, not to just let it go away and not to just assume it will take care of itself, but in fact to talk to people, go public, keep this issue alive, and that will have a better chance than just sitting by and waiting for something to happen. So we have, I think, tried to take CBS's advice and do that with the other journalistic organizations that are involved.
Can we go back a little bit? How did you realize that there was something wrong? What kind of arrangements do you have with Neil, for instance, when he goes out to report something and there's danger involved?
Well, first of all of the reporters are clearly told, because I told them before they left, that you know, the most important thing is to come back, not the story. The story comes second. So we hope that they don't put themselves in a situation of great risk if they can possibly avoid it, that the story definitely comes second. So we assume that Neil was operating under those instructions and was unaware that something would happen or it would be held at all. We are in contact with him twice a day because he's filing twice a day and has since he went to the Gulf originally. But in Kuwait City, he was filing, and he filed Sunday morning and he filed again Sunday evening, and had planned this was to be a one-day trip up to the Basra area to see if he could find out what was going on. He was to be back by Monday night and be in touch with us, and we assume file a story for Monday evenings, all things considered. When he did not come back last night and we did not get in touch with him, we certainly began to worry and started the process. But at that time, it was, you know, an overdue reporter, and we know how difficult it is to get phones, especially international phones, and to get in contact. It's not so easy. So, you know, a few hours delay sometimes, even missing one cycle of the news program, is understandable in the circumstances. But it was really by this morning, when we still had not heard from him, then it becomes a much different matter. And when we see how many other journalists are in a similar situation, 26, 27 journalists is a lot. So we know that something has happened, and that's when we really started moving on this.
Did it seem safe to you to be driving into Iraq now? Did you have any sense of the situation?
Well, we know there's a chaotic situation in the Basra area, and if it were up to me to say go or no go, I would certainly not have recommended that Neil go right now to do that. He's using his own information there and with other reporters, and I think probably from a journalistic side made a good decision that they thought they could go and get as close as they could to see what was happening. That's a decision that you have to make in the field, and you can't make every day back here in Washington for a reporter. We just simply don't have all the information to know what went into it, what the decision was, and how it was made, and what they were operating under. So there's a lot of things we need to find out about, and I hope we will.
Is the American military willing to work with you on this, and are they working with you?
We believe they are. We certainly have been in contact with Pete Williams at the Pentagon starting last night through the night, and again this morning a number of times. The Pentagon says very clearly that the ceasefire agreement that they have with Iraq says that all foreign nationals who have been detained are to be released. Those detained before the ceasefire, and presumably those detained since the ceasefire. So we think it's clear the agreement that the military has with the Iraqi government and Iraqi military officials is that these people should be released. So we're operating under the assumption that the Pentagon and the military in Saudi Arabia is operating under that same assumption, that these people should be released, and they are working for that. The problem is the military does not control that area. The American checkpoint was the last point where American military control really ended, and then it was into Iraqi control. And given the ceasefire, they cannot really change that on the ground right now. Our issue here is not with the U.S. military, certainly it's with the Iraqi government, and clearly the Iraqi military, specifically, we believe, the Republican Guards.
Are the American military pool still in effect, and is that influencing at all the kind of response you're getting from the American military?
The pool system has really fallen by the wayside since the end of the war, and clearly it was not operating in this case at all. Reporters have been going on their own and doing their own things, and there are still some pools, and there are still some escorts and military escorts and that sort of thing, but that was not operating in this case at all, and really has not been operating in Kuwait City to a very great extent. Neil was doing some things on a pool there, but many more things. Deborah Amos, our other reporter, is also in Kuwait City, and they're operating much, much on their own, finding out things, talking to Kuwaitis, and doing their own reporting and filing their own reporting, And we haven't been saying on our air that this was reviewed by the military or anything like that, because they are operating outside any kind of controlled pool system.
Have you ever been in this position before, Bill?
Nope, I haven't. It's funny because we've worked very hard here to cover this war and the leading up to the war and the aftermath of the war. There's been, around-the-clock work by lots and lots of people through this whole period. And when the war itself ended, the fighting ended, I felt great relief because we had 7 of our own people out in that area in Iraq. Scott Simon clearly was in Iraq and with the military and other people at different points, and I was very worried. I've never sent someone to do that sort of thing, and it was a great concern of mine. When the war ended, I thought, great, we did it. We covered it, and everybody's fine, and I felt great relief. And obviously, I just happened to write on our daily critique yesterday that covering the peace can be even harder, and it's turning out to be.
You know, it's funny. Neil Conan was one of the people who really designed the NPR war coverage.
As the managing editor in the long lead up to the war, he clearly was the key person putting together NPR's war coverage planning and contingency planning. So he had a great hand in it, and from his own point of view, very much wanted to be involved in the coverage directly. He's a great military analyst.
Yeah, but he was probably one of the people most concerned about the safety of the reporters who he was helping to send out.
Yep.
What kind of leverage does the United States have now with the ceasefire already in effect?
Well, I think we control a great deal of the country. It's probably the best leverage. We also control many, many thousands of POWs. Certainly, I would think the United States government would be in a position to put a lot of pressure on for any number of things. We want them to focus on this issue and this one, and so far as we know, they are, and we think that's good.
Well, we all hope that we hear good news very soon. And, Bill, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Bill Buesenberg is NPR's Vice President for News and Information Programs. Coming up, we talk about the conflict in southern Iraq with Middle East scholar R.K. Ramazani. This is Fresh Air. The area in southern Iraq that the missing journalists were trying to reach is the scene of unrest, fighting between forces loyal to Saddam Hussein and those opposed to his rule. The opposition is largely composed of Shiite Muslims. Saddam is a Sunni Muslim, but Shiite Muslims make up more than half the population of the country. Shiites are also the majority group in Iran. Professor R.K. Ramazani is an Iranian scholar. He was born in Iran and is the author of many books about Iranian history and foreign policy. I spoke with him earlier today about Iran's changing role in the region, but first I wanted to know if he thought the unrest in Iraq was mainly a religious conflict between Sunnis and Shiites.
What is going on in Iraq today is really a popular uprising. I believe firmly that to put had a structure of Shia-Sunni sectarian conflict on this would be really distorting it. It is one that appeals a lot to the Western audiences. It so happens that the majority of these people are Shia Muslims, but that they are not doing so because they are Shia and because it is against Sunnis. Because it so happens that the Sunni government, the minority ruling in Iraq, has treated the Shias very badly for decades in terms of assassinations, in terms of purging, in terms of arresting, harassing, and so on. This has been going on for a long time. And if they had not been treated badly, they would not have probably been as dissatisfied.
The United States has made it very clear that it would not shed a tear if Saddam Hussein was overthrown. But do you think the United States would feel that its interests were best represented if Saddam Hussein was overthrown by a Shiite group?
The critical question for us as Americans is whether the substitute regime would be a better one insofar as U.S. interests are concerned. And that is that remains to be seen. The fact of these ringleaders, so to speak, so far as we know up to this time, being Shia, does not necessarily mean that they are anti-American or anti-Western.
Iran managed to stay neutral
yes.
during the war,
yes.
Although Iraqi planes were flown to Iran, and we still don't know exactly what that was about. But still, Iran managed to stay neutral. What do you think they're looking for in the, you know, post-war era in the Gulf, where everybody's trying to negotiate a new sense of power for their country?
Sure, that's correct. I think Iranian government today has been indeed positioning itself for the post-war era. Therefore, for example, the attempt on the part of the Rafsanjani government to mediate between Iraq and the United States even was part of that, so to speak, positioning. And even Secretary Baker, in giving his congressional testimony, accepted the idea, at least, as he verbalized Iran as a major power in the region. So certainly Iranians would like to see regional cooperation. They are very serious about not wanting foreign military presence, especially, I assume, that means ground forces. They seem to have accepted the proposition that they have to coexist with their neighbors. And that has been the dominant theme.
You say that Iran has changed in the past few years. I think many Americans think of Iran politically as it was in the days of the Ayatollah Khomeini, when Americans were held hostage in Iran. Why and how has it changed? Has it changed because of the leadership of President Rafsanjani?
Well, it's that is not the whole thing. There have been many factors. Let's say, first of all, today Iran's power centers are dominated by pragmatic elements, such as President Rafsanjani. The presidency, the judiciary, the Supreme Council, National Council. So that is one point. That is the primacy of influence in government circles by pragmatic elements. That's one factual matter. The second one is the fact that Iran's economy has been in shambles. It had nearly 8 years of imposed war on it by Iraq, and it has made reconstruction, economic reconstruction, its number one priority. It has come to have for the first time its five-year plan for economic reconstruction and development. And therefore, they have tried to change their relationship with the rest of the world, to enter the world market economy and reestablish diplomatic relations. I could give you quick examples. The relationship with France has been much improved. The one with Britain, they have reestablished diplomatic relations with Britain. With other European countries, Germany has had good relations with Iran all along. So Iran today is not a renegade state, so to speak. It has a lot intensive ties.
R.K. Ramazani is professor of government and foreign affairs at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Thank you. This week, right after The Simpsons, the Fox Network is premiering a new program called Yearbook. It's a documentary series that follows a group of students at a suburban Chicago high school through their senior year. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
I remember a few years ago when I sat down to preview the first episode of a documentary series called Cops. It was from the Fox Network, which was doing pretty awful stuff at the time, and I didn't expect much. But Cops surprised and delighted me, not only because the cameras were less obtrusive than I'd expected, but because the people in the Video Verite documentary acted so naturally. The same thing happened when I watched the first two episodes of Yearbook. I didn't expect much, and the preface to my preview tape was even worse than I'd feared.
Hello, my name is Susan Bridge, and I'm the principal at Glenbard West High School. For the last 6 months, Glenbard West and its staff and students and community members have been experiencing something that is very unique, for we have been participating in a documentary entitled Yearbook, which you are about to see previews of.
A principal should know better than to qualify the word unique. Even so, I get her point. Even if Yearbook isn't more unique than Cops, it's a lot less potentially exploitive, and a lot more involving than American Chronicles, the uneven Mark Frost-David Lynch documentary series that Fox launched earlier in the season. The first episode of Yearbook has to do with the selection of the school's homecoming queen. The second has to do with seniors watching the news to see if they, or their loved ones, will be shipped off to war in the Gulf. In each episode, there's a complex web of emotions on display, a reminder that high school, for every generation of kids that goes through it, is a complicated and unforgettable experience. In the homecoming episode, cameras are in the classrooms to record the reactions of all three girls nominated. And the same girl who giggles about being nominated for homecoming queen in the first episode is seen again in the second episode, crying about the fact that her boyfriend Joe has been called to active duty in the Gulf. Meanwhile, some of her fellow students sing a recycled protest song from the 60s, while a senior named Todd signs up for the Marines, struggles through training sessions, and sings a song of his own.
From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli.
In Yearbook, we get to know these young adults very quickly and very well. Young viewers will enjoy watching Yearbook to identify with one of the kids or one of the high school cliques. And, no matter how many years have passed, so will older viewers. High school doesn't seem to have changed all that much since I went through it, which is kind of reassuring and scary at the same time. Yearbook is deeper than I expected, and so, I'm happy to report, are most of the kids at Profiles.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the new film, The Silence of the Lambs, Dr. Hannibal Lecter is anybody's worst dream come true. He's a brilliant psychiatrist who's also a sociopathic killer and a cannibal. Coming up, Anthony Hopkins tells us how he used his own nightmares to play the part of Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter. Also, we talk with Hopkins about working with David Lynch on The Elephant Man and with Laurence Olivier at the National Theatre in London. Anthony Hopkins coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A black cloud hangs over Kuwait today, the result of oil fires set by the departing Iraqi army. U.S. oil experts are arriving in the country to help put these fires out, a job that may take up to 2 years. Four U.S. companies are involved in the cleanup effort, as NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Kuwait City.
Four American companies are starting work on putting out the oil fires in Kuwait. It's too big a job for one company, said an American helicopter pilot who flew over the oil fields today. The black smoke cloud reaches 12,000 feet, according to the pilot, but the black cloud blocks out the sun at noon. There are an estimated 600 oil wells burning. Millions of barrels of oil are going up in flames. The job to stop the fires is made more difficult because the areas around the oil fields and the offices are not yet secure. There are nightly gun battles as the Kuwaiti army continues to round up Iraqi stragglers. In Kuwait City, this is Deborah Amos.
Iraq has announced that its annexation of Kuwait has been annulled. According to the official Iraqi news agency, the government has nullified all decrees and laws involving Kuwait approved since the August 2nd invasion. The news agency says the action was taken in accordance with Iraq's agreement to adhere to all conditions of UN Security Council Resolution 686. Some 27 Western journalists are missing in southern Iraq. Among them is NPR's Neil Conan, who has not been seen since Monday morning. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Conan and reporter Chris Hedges of the New York Times left Kuwait City together Monday morning, headed for Basra. They were not part of a military pool, and they left ahead of a convoy of other Western reporters. They were last seen later that morning on the road to Basra. At the Pentagon, Marine Corps Major General Martin Brattner said the U.S. military had little information on the reporters' fate.
Right now, our indications are that they were off on their own. They were in the Basra area. They were unescorted. They were in what we consider to be unfriendly territory. We don't know any more than that at this point in time.
It's thought that Conan and the other journalists may be held by the Republican Guard in Basra. Conan has worked at the network here since 1977. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
The State Department says the Iraqi government is using Republican Guard units in an effort to control unrest. A State Department spokeswoman says that government control may have been restored in a few of the areas where unrest has been reported, but she declined to say if Baghdad has ever lost control. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials climbed over 58 points to close at 2,972.52. on volume of 254 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 4-1 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Iraq has turned over to the International Red Cross 35 more prisoners of war, whom Iraqi officials say are the last held by Baghdad. Meanwhile, bad weather delayed the release of the first Iraqi prisoners. A Red Cross spokesman says in the group freed by Iraq, there are 15 Americans, 9 Britons, 9 Saudis, 1 Kuwaiti, and 1 Italian. The U.S. Central Command says that plans to fly the Allied prisoners out of Iraq and to fly close to 300 Iraqis home were canceled because of rainy weather and high winds. With the U.S.-led military effort in the Persian Gulf wrapping up, President Bush is directing his attention to domestic matters. Today he addressed a summit meeting of law enforcement officials on violent crime. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The president is moving fast to capitalize on his record-high popularity ratings. Today he met with Republican congressional leaders to formulate a legislative strategy for pushing his domestic agenda, and he spoke out in favor of getting fast-track authority to win approval of a new free trade pact with Mexico. References to the Gulf War victory have been a common theme. Today the president spoke to a Justice Department gathering of the nation's top police officers and prosecutors.
Now that the shooting is stopped overseas, we've got to redouble our efforts to silence the guns here at home.
The president called for more prisons and congressional approval of his new anti-crime package. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
According to the AAA, gasoline prices were down again last week, dropping by more than 2.5 cents to an average of $1.08 a gallon for self-service regular. Since December 18th, gasoline prices have fallen more than 29 cents for a gallon of self-service regular. The Bush administration has repeated its opposition to federal aid to help out the nation's airlines. Some officials have proposed letting airlines keep a 10% domestic ticket tax. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Movie audiences are taking to a psychopathic anti-hero in Jonathan Demme's film The Silence of the Lambs. Dr. Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter is a brilliant psychiatrist who is also a demented killer, demented enough to eat his victims, effete enough to wash them down with a glass of Chianti. This chilling and perverse performance was created by my guest Anthony Hopkins. Hopkins also played the humane doctor in David Lynch's film The Elephant Man. In The Silence of the Lambs, Jodie Foster plays Clarice Starling, an FBI investigator who visits Lecter in prison, hoping his brilliant criminal mind will reveal clues to help her track another serial killer known as Buffalo Bill.
I'm offering you a psychological profile of Buffalo Bill based on the case evidence. I'll help you catch him, Clarice.
You know who he is, don't you? Tell me who decapitated your patient, Doctor.
All good things to those who wait. I've waited, Clarice, but how long can you and old Jackie boy wait? Our little Billy must already be searching for that next special lady.
Hopkins portrays a highly educated madman. I asked him how he came up with the character's voice.
When I was assured that the part was on offer to me, I started to work on it and simply to learn the lines and think about it. And it was such a well-written part, and the story was so compelling, that when I, after the first reading, I heard the voice of Hannibal Lecter. It sort of, I heard it in my head, I saw a vision of it, I saw what he looked like. Well, not strictly within the first reading, but let's say maybe 2 or 3 readings of the script. Because my work is kind of quite simple. I just learn it, you know, before I start filming. Just learn the text, learn the words. And the voice came. And for some reason, I don't know why, the voice in fact identified the character for me, and I saw within a few more days what he looked like, the hair being slicked back and the way he moved, his grace and elegance.
Describe what you did with your voice.
Well, it was one of the... There was one line, which I think you've seen on the trailers, and I said, I'll help you catch him, Clarice. I don't know what it was. It was just a kind of tone, and there's a speech where he says... one of the speeches that made me understand, man, was he said, you know what you look like to me with your good bag and your cheap shoes? You look like a rube, a well-scrubbed, hustling rube with a little taste. And I thought, that's it. That's the character.
You know, there's something both very effete, very scary and very purring about the voice.
Yes.
Well,
the thing is, if you're playing an evil character, if you're playing somebody who's mad or evil,
mm-hmm.
Well, let's say, just take the first part. If you're playing somebody who's mad, the thing is not to play him mad, but to play the opposite, play him as ultra sane. If you're playing somebody who's evil, play the good side of him. And that makes him more scary because you humanize him. Because nobody is all evil. Nobody is all good. Whatever those terms mean, but nobody is all one thing. So what I do as an actor is to find out what the other side of the character is. And I found out with Lecter that, in fact, I think his problem is, or his peculiar psychology is, that he is so in control of himself, mentally, spiritually, physically, whichever way, he's so totally in control of every aspect of his thinking that he is completely mad, because nobody can be in that much control. It's as if he is so sane, he's flipped over into the world of the dark and the irrational.
No, I don't know if this is connected to the control you see the characters having, but you rarely blink in the movie. I mean, the eyes have a fixed stare and they're wide open all the time.
Yes. Well, I don't know. I didn't analyze much about the part. I mean, I just had a hunch on how to play him. First of all, when you're playing a character like this, you have to like him. The actor has to somehow like him. And I think there's something very terrifying about people who are unblinking. It's that they are so certain. They have no doubts, no uncertainty. And they're so certain that makes them terrifying. If you look at all the great monstrous political leaders in our century, you know.
One of which you've played.
Yes.
Yes.
Old Adolf, yes. They rise to power because they're so certain, they have no doubts. Their minds already made up. Somebody said of Hitler, a journalist who interviewed Hitler in 1936, before the war, she said, Hitler has in his library 1,000 books. He hasn't read any one of them. But of course he doesn't need to because his mind is already made up. And I found that the most apocalyptic, frightening vision of a man. And I think it's the same with Lecter. He knows with absolute certainty what he is and what everyone else is around him.
What kind of kidding took place on the set in between shooting?
We had a lot of fun. We had a lot of laughs on the set. I'd go up behind people. There'd be people working on the... women working on the props or something, or, you know, some of the guys walked around. I got behind them and said, good evening. Are you having pleasant dreams? And they'd sort of jump because they got used to this character I was playing. And I, at the end of the day shooting, you know, they get into the elevator and I creep in afterwards. I say, I got you all in my elevator. So they used to sort of freak out, but not seriously, but it was a joke. It was a kind of funny joke. Everyone on the set was very happy. I mean, everyone seemed to work very... with a great deal of ease.
Anthony Hopkins, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And Anthony Hopkins is my guest. You can see him now as Dr. Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter in the film Silence of the Lambs. This is Fresh Air. Actor Anthony Hopkins is my guest. You've said that you really liked working with Jonathan Demme. Is there any kind of direction that he gave you that is different from what you're used to getting? Is there something different about the style that he works in?
I think the great hallmark, for me anyway, of the great sort of positive for me is when directors, it's not that they exactly leave you alone, but what they do, they let you develop the character. And it's really a question of trust. And what I felt with Jonathan was that he had total trust in me as an actor. And because he paid me that compliment, I had total trust in him as a director. And I'd seen some of his films. I'd seen Something Wild, Married to the Mob. And I thought I knew that I was in the hands of a very skilled craftsman. He would listen to some of my suggestions that I wanted to do. And, you know, there were two ideas I came up with that he thought were excellent, and he let me get on with them.
Are those the ideas that you mentioned?
Well, no, it was just, he asked me, he said, how do you feel about, how would you like to first be seen, you know, when the film spends a lot of time talking about Lecter before they see him. And I said, well, if you don't mind, I said, I'd like to just be seen standing right in the middle of the cell, as if I'm waiting for her. And he said, God, that's weird. He said, well... I said, well, it's the most terrifying thing I can think of is the very monster that she's listened to and heard about when she actually goes towards him and she comes into eye contact, comes into the area of his cell, there he is staring straight at her with a nice smile on his face. And I sensed my own psyche, whatever that means, that's the most terrifying thing. That's the sort of base of my nightmares, in a way, or it was as a child.
Somebody waiting for you?
Somebody waiting for me in the corner, in the top of the stairs, or... I used to have a dream. I'd open the door when I was a child. There'd be banging on the front door of the house in the dark. It was always moonlight. And as I opened the door, there'd be nobody there, but across the street, in a window, three floors up in the building opposite, there was a face staring out at me and smiling. That was the most terrifying nightmare. In itself, it doesn't sound frightening, but there's something strange about that. And this is what I wanted to do to the audience. I wanted them to just take that moment of horror when they see Lecter, that they don't see somebody with blood dripping off his mouth. They see a very pleasant, normal-looking man standing to attention in the middle of his hour. Very weird.
You know, it's interesting. You've worked with the two most offbeat, stylish the younger directors, Jonathan Demme and David Lynch. And they're maybe the two most idiosyncratic in the kinds of movies that they make. And I think it's interesting that you, a British actor coming from the National Theatre, you know, from a more classic theatre, has ended up working with them.
Well, I mean, I've been trying for years to break away from that image of the British National Theatre. I mean, I've worked there and I've enjoyed myself. I've had a good time there, but... It's something I've been predominantly interested in films and especially American movies. I've always been a fan of American films ever since I was a kid. So working with somebody like Lynch or Demme is always an experience. I mean, David Lynch and Demme are, I think, I don't know, I haven't seen David for 10 years, 12 years or whatever it's been, but I think they're two opposites in a way. I mean, they're both quirky, they're both idiosyncratic, but they... I remember, I can recall David's methods were probably different to Jonathan's. Jonathan seemed to be very precise. He knew what he wanted immediately, I think. David was living in another world. He had a sort of an inner film going on in his own mind anyway, and he saw visions and images that he wanted. And I remember, actually, I regret it now, but I was rather... I used to feel kind of irritated because I didn't know what he wanted. But watching his movies since, like Blue Velvet and... Wild at Heart. I see, you know, that the man's got, you know, he's got such a powerful image in his own mind, but he has his own way of translating it.
Well, let me ask you this. When you were doing that scene where you see the Elephant Man for the first time, and of course, in real life, you weren't looking at anything, you know, because John Hurt wasn't made up yet. Did you use sense memory or anything to get involved with an emotion from your past that would make you feel the way the character is supposed to be feeling? Do you do that?
No, I remember that morning. What I do remember very clearly was that I was feeling... I'd been hanging around for days, actually, and I was feeling particularly vulnerable. And I suppose a bit depressed. I don't know what it was about. I can't remember. And I remembered I fixed my eye on a spot on the wall, and for some reason, I can't understand it to this day what happened, but the 23rd Psalm, which is used by John Hurt in the film, in fact, but the 23rd Psalm came into my mind. Now, I don't know why. I hadn't remembered it since I'd been in school, and for some reason, it came into my mind, and I remember the... overpowering impressions when I was a child in school of green hills and valleys and lakes, which were around my hometown when I was a child, and the woods and the forests and the valley and all that. And it was a very strange sensation. I was fixed my... There was a chalk spot on the wall opposite me. I fixed my eye on that, and this inner voice... It was my own voice, but it was like a memory, like a kind of recitation of... The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, he maketh me. And it must have had the right emotional reaction, because that's what happened. I don't understand it, and I'm glad David Lynch didn't ask me to do it again, because I probably wouldn't have been able to repeat it. Because those things happen once in a while, you know, and you can't really rely upon them. They happen or they don't happen. And if they don't happen, you have to do it purely technical.
You know, both of the movies that we've been talking about, Silence of the Lambs and The Elephant Man, you, in both of them you play very educated people. And I'm wondering what kind of education you had yourself.
Well, I was hopeless at school. I was a non-starter. When I was at school, 4 years of age, I didn't understand what the teachers were talking about. I was way behind everyone else. And looking back on it, I suppose that's why I became an actor. A lot of actors I know, there are exceptions to the rule. I know some actors who were very, very clever and went to university and college and all that. But I was one of those who just didn't know what time of day it was. I was living in another world, except I didn't know what world that was that I was inhabiting. So, as I started growing up, I became quite a mimic, because I suppose this was my way of coping and a sense of belonging by being able to imitate authority like schoolmasters and, you know. But as a student, I was hopeless. I guess I was what they call slow or backward. I certainly wasn't very swift academically, so when I get to play these intelligent parts now, these very erudite men, I have to laugh or smile to myself, because that's the last thing I am, is erudite. I mean, I've sort of educated myself over the years, you know, I read a lot, I read quite a lot, and I've tried to reform my education.
You know, I've seen several articles in which you've been compared to Richard Burton, who, like you, is from Wales. Is that why you're compared, because you're both from the same place?
Well, we're from the same town.
So did he have, like, significance to you when you were coming of age wanting to act?
Yes, he represented to me freedom, because I couldn't function in school. I mean, I'm making it sound terrible, actually. I mean, it wasn't that bad. But I mean, I was a bit lonely, you know. I just wanted to get out of where I was, because it didn't seem I had much future. I had no qualifications from school. What could I be? So Burton represented to me glamour, freedom, and all that. And the only time I met him was when I went to ask him for his autograph when I was about 15 years of age, and I remember thinking, when I left his house, he'd signed my autograph book. That, God, I wish I could be like that, you know. I wish I could be him, or I wish I could be famous or something like that. And it was the rocket fuel, I guess, or that resentment or anger or whatever it was, that drove me on. And ironically, the strange thing was, as fate will have it, I next met Richard Burton in the dressing room in New York in the Plymouth Theatre. I'd started the play Equus in New York in 1974, and Richard Burton took over in 1976. So it was a very strange twist of fate, and that's the second and last time I met him.
Another one of those highly educated parts, I'll point out.
Yes, it was.
You're playing the psychiatrist.
Yes. But it was extraordinary meeting Richard in those days, because they are sitting in the same dressing room. He said, "Why haven't we ever worked before? Why haven't we ever worked together?" And he said, "We come from the same town." I said, "Yeah." He said, "My God, this is weird." But sadly, I never worked with him. It's a great loss that he died.
Anthony Hopkins is my guest. He's currently starring as Dr. Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter in the film The Silence of the Lambs. More in just 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Reports tonight of further unrest in southern Iraq between Iraq's Republican Guard and opponents of the government of Saddam Hussein. It's said to be an incipient civil war. Some accounts have the government forces gaining the upper hand in some of the areas. 35 Allied prisoners of war released in Baghdad to Red Cross there. 26 journalists still reported as missing in southern Iraq, including NPR's Neil Conan, who hasn't been heard from since Sunday evening, Gulf time. We'll do some checking on the rest of the world. Reports from the Horn of Africa, South Africa, and NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports on relief efforts in Liberia.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Actor Anthony Hopkins is my guest. Now, you early on in your career, you performed at the National Theater, the theater company founded by Laurence Olivier. He was there for the audition?
Yes, I was interviewed by him, and he auditioned me. And he was playing Othello at the time. And I'd been called in to do this audition for him, and I didn't know any other Shakespeare, you know. Not being the most erudite actor in the world, but the only piece I knew was from Othello. And Olivia just opened in a resounding success in the National Theatre. This has gone back almost, 27 years ago. And he asked me, he said, what audition piece are you going to do? I said, Othello. He said, "You've got a nerve, haven't you?" said. And anyway, I did the piece, and he took me in and asked me to join the company. And we became, well, he was a different generation. He was a much older man than me, but than myself. But we became friends, you know, and I got to know him over the years. We didn't become close friends because there's a huge generation gap. But he took me under his wing. I was one of his favorite actors. I think I was his favorite because I was very rebellious. I was a bit of a troublemaker. And I think secretly, he sort of admired that. I mean, he was a great disciplinarian. You know, he didn't like people causing trouble. But in a way, if you were troublesome, he respected that in a way. It made him smile, I think.
What kind of trouble did you cause at the National Theatre?
Well, I used to go and demand work. I said, give me a part. And they said, well, you've only just joined the company. I said, I don't give a damn. I said, I'll go back and work in rep. I said, give me a part. You know, I'm going to have to stand around carrying spears for the rest of my life. And he got to hear about this, and he said, you're very feisty at your heart, you know, dear boy. And anyway, he gave me some good breaks and good chances. And I was very, very pugnacious, very arrogant, very aggressive. And looking back, I'm glad I was. I've had to sort of jettison a lot of that as the years have gone by, because it's finally it's something, it's a kind of ballast that you no longer need as you get older, I think. So I'm much more at ease with myself now, and not so feisty.
What would you call Olivier when you worked with him and knew him?
Larry.
Not Sir Larry or anything?
No, he there was a time when he gave you permission. He said you'd call him Sir, you know, he'd say, you can call me Larry. So you call him Larry. It's always a great privilege then. But I got to know him over the years, and he was a very funny man. He was an extraordinary man. A great, great actor. The greatest sort of theatrical talent of his age, I think. The people say, you know, who's the next Olivier? I don't think there's anyone will ever. There is no one who will touch him.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasant dreams.
Actor Anthony Hopkins, he stars in The Silence of the Lambs. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. Fresh Air's producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist James Ridgway about the racist, anti-Semitic hate groups on the extreme fringes of American politics. It's the subject of his new book and film. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.